Accession number 27202, Colonel James Dowson, Real 9. We were talking about when you moved to the British Military Hospital at Rindhelm near Hanover in 1969. So, very much the same kind of thing as before, from what we're looking at. Anything
yes.
Different about your time there?
Military practice involved a lot of really you were free to expand that practice in any direction you wanted or leave it unexpanded. I was always keen to make contact with local people. I made contact with a practitioner in Hanover who spoke fluent English, and I also took on a trainee in Rindhelm, a chap called Brian Hopkinson, who had been up in Fallingbostel with the armoured regiments up there on the Lüneburg Heath, and he wanted to specialise in ophthalmology, and he was a regimental medical officer, Cambridge graduate, and it was really, I suppose I enjoyed it, but it all seems domestic and rather feeble now, I suppose.
So you basically were taking this chap on to help him.
Yes, but you see, this is the sort of thing that in England would only take place in a teaching hospital, and I just had this practice of largely young people, so a lot of squints and refractions to do, and not an awful lot of what you might call standard ophthalmology. But I took him on. I remember he had a sort of cheeky face, and still has, I imagine. And I remember meeting him in Hanover, and he introduced himself, and he said, before we proceed, I think I ought to tell you that I was considered not to be suitable for higher professional training. So I said, well, that's a start. And we got on like a house on fire. It really was a very improving experience for me to take on what you might call an apprentice.
And did he make progress?
He made progress, all right. He passed his exams, and he's consultant in Northampton now. I remember compliments he paid me. We used to go to St. Thomas's after Harold Ridley. The consultant advisor in ophthalmology was a chap called John Winstanley, and he was the consultant at St. Thomas's, and one or two cases of particular complexity and so on, we had to send them back to St. Thomas's, and on occasions we were back there ourselves, and then to sort of polish up Brian Hopkinson's preparedness for exams, he went there for 6 months or so, and I remember being over there, and he'd got to know the people, the junior staff as well as the consultants in St. Thomas's, and they'd got to know, because the RAMC headquarter mess was just along at Millbank, they'd got to know a lot of RAMC officers, so they had an attitude towards RAMC officers that was based on the experience of the denizens of the RMC mess. I remember the compliment that Brian paid me without, I suppose, doing it self-consciously. He didn't sort of set me up for it, anything like that. There was the gang of senior people from St. Thomas's were in the mess, and I walked in. He said, now I want you to introduce you to a real ophthalmologist, and I thought, well, that's very nice of him.
And so what was the, I mean, you wouldn't go out with the army with an exercise or anything, this was just routine clinic?
That's right, we didn't actually go out on exercises unless there was a hospital one, and there were hospital exercises where you all...
What was a hospital, tell us about a hospital exercise then.
Well, we had to up sticks and go and occupy some building and convert it into a hospital, basically. We were given a kind of barracks or derelict building in Germany, or part of an unoccupied barracks building, and had it converted into wards and other kind of accommodation, and received casualties as an exercise.
And how efficiently did the exercise progress? I mean, was it something the hospital was tuned up to do?
No, it wasn't. We tended to take them a bit lightheartedly and do them rather poorly. But there were time stopped. You knew it, in 5 days it was all going to be over, so that was fine.
Do you think it would have been efficient in reality?
I think if it was real, then we would have perhaps changed our attitude quite a lot. And it was possible to see how we would really cope. I suppose it drew attention to the fact that the real problems that had to be solved. We didn't solve them in the exercise, but you knew for real we would get on with it and solve them.
How did you get on with the German civilians? You worked amongst them.
Generally speaking, the German civilians were, just friendly. We spoke a different language, that's all. Didn't feel any particular distance from them. Just blended in with them.
And they'd come to your clinic. You did do work amongst them?
No, we very rarely saw German civilians in the hospital. It was the people who worked for the military. You see them, but not others. They would go to their own clinics and so on.
Now, anything else about your time in Germany? You went out there in 69. How long were you there for?
Until 71. I think 71.
What was your next posting?
Back to Kattrick.
To the same hospital.
Which then, it was the old military hospital that had been built to accommodate the wounded of the First World War.
Not the same hospital.
It was the same hospital. It was a wooden hospital, and accommodated the wounded of the First World War, who were transported by train and they had a sort of station there, which detrained the wounded into the hospital and then treated them. So it'd be not acutely wounded, long-term wounded. It was a hospital that had then sort of continued on long after its primary purpose had ceased, treated the local population, but was getting very old, and they were redesigned a new one, and we moved into the new one and sort of commissioned it, you might say.
And how did that compare?
Well, it was a modern hospital built along lines of sort of state-of-the-art type of thing.
As good as what you'd get in the NHS?
Yes, it was really sort of standard NHS district hospital model.
Now, this is your second term here then. Anything new?
I made a much stronger association with the local eye specialists in Darlington and took on some of the less popular work. I thought to myself, how to ingratiate yourself with your colleagues. Answer to do all the things they don't like doing begin to enjoy them yourself. Now, one particularly irritating problem in the specialty is the watering eye, the eye that constantly waters. It's a great nuisance to the sufferer, not just because the eye waters and feels uncomfortable, but because it interferes with your vision. You're always blinking and it's not quite clear, and it interferes with the clear eyesight of the other eye and so on. So you go blink, splosh, and you can't see. If you're looking for a road sign, for instance, you're doing this and you want to rub your eye, and so on. By the time you've done all the thing to get clear vision, the road sign's gone. So it terrible nuisance. But it's also a terrible nuisance to eye specialists because the operation to relieve it is done on the side of the nose through the bone at the side of the nose. You make an alternative channel. And it was unpopular. They would like to have had a simple solution. This operation takes about an hour. And they would like an operation that would take about 5 minutes. So I went to my local people and said, I will do all the watering eyes you send to me. And they were delighted. So was I. And I found that it was educative as well as anything else. I learned an awful lot about how to deal with watering eyes and to sympathize with the sufferers, something that my colleagues found hard to do because they would rather that they went away. As a result of that, getting my feet under the table, I suppose, I actually came out of the army in 1978.
So you were at Catterick Hospital about 7 years, seven or eight years then?
Yeah, I'm just trying to think. I must have... I'm dredging my memory now. I went to Rintown in 69, 70, 71. It must have been 73 when I came.
Oh, so you were at Rintown longer?
Yes. Rintown came in 73 and then 5 years in Catterick. And that got me to 16 years of reckonable service. And also, having done all the watering eyes and other unpopular procedures with my colleagues, a vacancy came up in Darlington, and I applied for it and got it and left the army.
Now, how did you feel about leaving the army?
At first I was very happy, and then I realised that there were aspects of living army life, if you like, which appealed to me. Wouldn't be able to define them precisely, just a feeling that you get. I suppose it's the family feeling of army life, you know, brother officers and things like that. I could talk to my colleagues in the army because it was a smaller hospital. I knew everybody. And in a big district general hospital like the Darlington Memorial Hospital, I knew very few people and cared even less about them.
Now you were an eye special at the Darlington Memorial Hospital.
Yes.
That was from 78 to...
Got to be careful, you know. Must have been... I'm just trying to think of when I actually left and went back into the army. And I'm just trying... It must have been 81.
So about 3 years at the Memorial Hospital.
Yes.
Now... How did you settle in? I mean, you were, you missed the army, but I mean, were you all right as an eye specialist in the sense of...
Oh, yes, I was all right as an eye specialist. I suppose I just missed the army atmosphere and life. In fact, that's all I could say about it. As I say, I knew everybody in the messes that I had been associated with, knew everybody, respected them, understood them, knew more about them than just that they were psychiatrists or general surgeons, things like that. And it was also, there was a lot more fun involved. It's hard to put a finger on that. Dermot Dunn, who was a surgeon, an Irishman, and he and I got on very well together. And I never let him do any eye operations, but I said, as a surgeon and a fellow of the Royal College of Surgeons, I felt a certain... disadvantage of not being able to do an appendectomy, take an appendix out, standard, bog standard, if you like, surgical operation. And so he taught me how to do an appendix. And that was fun. Now, it must seem odd, speaking to a non-medical person. But you asked me how it was different, and I think this is how it was different. It was very easy to get an atmosphere of just enjoying life of the doctor, you might say, and realizing that it had a sort of fellow feeling right across the specialties, whereas it was very narrow in the District General Hospital. So that if you're talking about reasons for doing a surgical operation, in the army situation, and we had plenty of clinical meetings, we took life quite seriously, and because, as I sometimes say in other contexts, it's a lot more fun if you take it seriously. And we would say, talking about surgical operations or reasons for doing things, particularly surgical operations, someone would suggest as one of the reasons it's fun to do. And this wasn't treated as some kind of blasphemy, or but it would have, in a district general hospital, you would have perhaps not been greeted in the same way as it was in an RUMC officer's mess.
How did things like pay and conditions of hours compare with the, between RAMC and the NHS?
Well, pay in the NHS was probably a bit better then. They were all always comparable, because that's what Drummond established. He established that pay and conditions of work ought to be comparable between the NHS and the RAMC. And to a certain extent, they were. It was much more difficult to get reasonable equipment in the army. You had to be very resourceful to squeeze that out of the defence budget. But you got used to techniques of doing that. You're asking about pay and conditions of work. Yes, there wasn't very much else to say.
Hours.
Oh. You always had to do orderly medical officer, no matter who you were in the army. So that meant you were on duty for the whole of the hospital, all the specialties, throughout the night hours. And that was... it wasn't all that popular, but it wasn't resented. And of course, it just didn't exist in a district general hospital. There was no such thing as an orderly medical officer. But orderly medical officer, in the end, one made a virtue out of it, and I learned an awful lot. One got a very much broader medical education all the time. It's ongoing medical education, being orderly medical officer at night once a week, or something like that. And so, hours of work, no one ever seemed... I mean, you got the ordinary time off, an ordinary working day, but there was never a feeling that you could say, not my department, go to hell, or something like that, which you perhaps could have done in a district general hospital. First of all, the person asking you to do something extra was at the very most your commanding officer, who would couldn't really be argued with you. Well, you could offer protest, but you still had to go on and do it, because he would put it in ways that you couldn't refuse. But also it might be a brother officer who was in a scrape. I can remember being asked if I would come and do orderly medical officer by a chap called Cope, Andy Cope. And I said, oh, come on, you know, I did it the night before last. He said, I did it last night. And he was stuck. So I just went and did it. And that was the kind of thing. You never felt that you were saying to yourself, well, that's it, I've done. No one else can ask me to do anything. So in the army, the idea of hours of work never seemed to be an issue.
Now, what triggered you to go back in roughly 1981? You're not quite sure about that, but what triggered you to return?
Wanderlust, perhaps. And this, you know, I told you about that girl who said the Far East was like a drug. There was an opportunity of going to Hong Kong, and it was an opportunity I couldn't resist. The chap who was advisor, a chap called Robert Youngson, and talking to him, said I could send you to Hong Kong. And I thought, oh God, I can't turn that up.
And what about your family?
The family were encouraging me. They said, yeah, you know, you can be a miserable bugger in Darlington. And they remembered the happy days of when they were young and we were sort of travelling around the world. So they encouraged me to go. And I went to Hong Kong.
Now, what was your posting there?
Again, that was the military hospital, which at that time was on Kowloon Peninsula. And again, it was ophthalmologist. There was nowhere else to go. It wasn't a travelling thing. And there I did see locals and operate on them, because I made friends with the local ophthalmologists and they worked in one of the local charity hospitals.
Did you enjoy, was there anything different about the sort of problems they were having there? I mean,
No, it was always very much the same. The young families with children and squints. There were Hong Kong locals who were employed by the British forces who were older, and there was a class. In order to expand the work of the military hospital, they invented a class of patient, and they did a sort of trade-off with the Queen Elizabeth Hospital, which was just across the road, and saw the overflow, if you like, of all classes of patients. So we used to do cataracts and glaucoma, things like
The name was just, was it just the Military Hospital Kowloon, or did it have a
British Military Hospital Kowloon, no, yes, BFP01.
And what did you take your family with you?
Yes, they came, although they were grown up at this time, and so my wife came out and the others stayed. They'd all sort of got themselves grown up, you might say, and my eldest daughter was living in London. My youngest daughter was doing nursing. Toby, who was the youngest son of four, he was at university doing geology. And my eldest son, Simon, was actually in the army.
And what were the married quarters like as compared to what you'd live in generally yourself? Do you see what I mean?
Married quarters are really rather splendid, particularly in the Far East. In Singapore, there were typical colonial houses with deep verandas and no air conditioning. Because air conditioning was, they antedated air conditioning. Air conditioning was later superimposed on them, but basically they were built to be as cool as possible without air conditioning, just with ceiling fans. And they were, they say the deep verandas were really rather nice, pleasant. And you got used to the warmth and humidity. In Hong Kong, which has seasons, you had to have an air conditioner that would both warm up the room in winter and cool it in summer. And there were flats that we lived in to begin with, because the quarters around the hospital were very limited, just about half a dozen or so of them. And we were fortunate that after living for about a year in a flat in a place called Kowloon Sao, which means Little Kowloon, some distance from the hospital, we then moved because there was a vacancy in one of the quarters just opposite the hospital, and that had a large veranda with a magnificent view of the harbour. And it was a one level flat, very spacious, with air conditioned bedrooms, and as I say, this veranda with a wonderful view, and it was really very pleasant indeed. A very short walk to work, just across the way, and very congenial.
Had eye specializations moved on at all, or were there any new treatments?
Intraocular lenses were coming in.
Again.
Yes, again. And
this is with the
people were asking for them.
This is the new lightweight one.
The new lightweight ones. People were asking for them. And the techniques I'd learned were not really all that suitable for the what are now standard intraocular lenses, which go behind the iris. the ones that I was able to put in were so-called anterior chamber lenses, which rest just behind the cornea. They're no longer standard at all, but at that time they satisfied the requirements, the reasonable requirements of the patient, and at the same time were compatible with the techniques, standard techniques of ophthalmology.
Were you keeping up to date?
Yes, I think I kept up to date. I was interested in keenly following these things.
Anything?
Because the operation I did was brought up on, trained on, was removing cataract and then correcting the vision of the eye afterwards. Putting in an intraocular lens is a completely different thing. You're restoring vision. And that was the thing that eventually you realize that that's a tremendous consideration. You've got to satisfy it. You can't say, my techniques don't allow me to do that. You just have to put up with that. The patient's very reasonable expectation is that if their eyesight is failing, what they want is not to have the cataract taken out, but they want their eyesight restored. If that means taking the cataract out, and that was all that you could do, then you did that, and then you restored their eyesight later with glasses and so on. It wasn't the same. In the case of intraocular lenses, you're restoring their vision by technique.
What about these?
Was the just as clear.
The sort of Russian techniques of correcting eyesight defects, normal eyesight defects, by cutting the lens.
Those actually.
Are you watching those?
They were coming in, but they actually haven't become standard, or didn't become standard until after I retired.
Now, anything else about your time? You sound as if you enjoyed yourself at Kowloon, well, Hong Kong.
Yes, there used to be a little tag about people like me. And they said to be army barmy. And I suppose in a way I was army barmy. I enjoyed the life, enjoyed mess life. And as I said to you, I enjoyed this sort of family feeling where you felt as if you knew every person as not just as a distant professional colleague, but as a fellow officer, I suppose. And there are very few words which exactly touch upon the thing, but the fact is that you felt, whatever word seems to be appropriate, a kind of esprit de corps, kind of fellow feeling, kind of solidarity. All these words are both appropriate and not quite right. There's something, bond, a very strong bond in an officer's mess, and that was true of the RMC hospital officer's mess as well. There were people you disliked and people you respected, people you didn't respect, but nevertheless you were bonded to them all and you had to put up with them all, and that was quite different from civilian life, you might say.